Okay, today is May 9th, 2008. This is Fidencio Marbella with the Melrose Park Public Library. Also present is Heidi Beasley, also with the Melrose Park Public Library. Today we will be speaking with Mr. Roger Braden. Roger served in the United States Air Force for 23 years. He was born on December 8th, 1949 in Concord, Massachusetts. Highest rank he achieved was as a major. This interview is being conducted for the Veterans History Project at the Library of Congress. Okay, let's go ahead and get started, Roger. Why don't you tell us when and where you were born and a little bit about your family growing up.
Okay. I was born December 8th, 1949 in Concord, Massachusetts, which is just about 5 miles from my actual hometown of Maynard, Massachusetts. Excuse me. I was the second of four children. I have an older brother who's passed away now and two younger sisters. I lived in the same room in the same house until I went to college after I graduated high school in 1967. And I went to college at a place called Westfield State College, which is in the western part of Massachusetts.
Okay. And then you decided to join the Air Force. Why was that?
I decided to join the Air Force because I had a low lottery number in the draft. I can't be anything but honest with you. My original motivations were not completely noble, but I wasn't inclined to flee to Canada or anything like that because, well, I was pretty typical for a graduating college student at the time and not approving of the war in Vietnam, which was going on when I graduated in 1971. I'd also been raised to believe that you don't make somebody else take your place. And so, assuming that I would be drafted, which is an open question at this point, I'm not sure how far they got down the numbers in that year, I joined the Air Force in September of 1971.
Okay. So where did you go for your initial training with the Air Force?
Okay. Well, I passed through the entrance station at Springfield, Massachusetts, and boot camp for the U.S. Air Force at that time was exclusively conducted at Lackland Air Force Base right outside of San Antonio, Texas. So that's where I went for boot camp.
Okay. So what was your first impression when you got to Lackland?
Like most everybody else's, probably pretty much a lot of uncertainty, a dose of abject fear, which of course was promoted. I mean, that's part of what they do for you, to you, at boot camp. They want you to leave behind a lot of what you brought with you, so to speak, as far as your attitudes and that kind of thing. And that was a reaction. Though I've never confirmed this, I really do believe that all of the scheduling of getting new recruits there was contrived to produce just what it did, which was that we arrived at the air, we landed in San Antonio at something like 10 or 10:30 at night, and we came off the airplane, and there was an NCO there to do reception, and reception consisted of the first dose of yelling and carrying on. And they put us on buses, and it was about 45 minutes to an hour to get to Lackland Air Force Base, which is on the sort of the southwest side of San Antonio, and the airport was north of town a little ways, and it's a good-sized city, so it takes a little while. And we arrived at something like midnight, and basically, from memory here, the first thing they did was take us to a chow hall to eat, of all things, at midnight. And I'm not sure exactly it was just to keep us moving, I think, honestly. So we ate, and we immediately had to produce a urine specimen for drug testing, yeah, right off the top. And after that was done, they took us to a place where we were divided into our groups or flights, as they were known. And again, bear in mind, this is still all, it's in the dead of the night, and reporting to the entrance station probably was about the same time for everybody, but reporting was 5 in the morning, Eastern time, and now it's midnight or 1 or 2 Central time. And it's part of what they had in mind, so they divided us up and brought us to the barracks, and our training instructor that we're known as gave us a lot of very important briefings, very little of which I remember at this point. But I do recall one thing we had this very specifically. They had a formatted postcard, I believe it was, and everybody had to address a postcard to their family and basically, "Hi, I'm doing fine," or something, you know, about one line, and those were immediately sent. I can see that it was important, especially if a family had never had anyone in the military and you send your son or your daughter all these thousands of miles away and you have no idea what's happening to them. So they went through all that and gave us some basic briefings on how and what we were going to do, and we turned in at something like, I'd like to say 2 or 2:30, and we were awakened at 5 to the sound of a heavy metal trash can being kicked down the aisle between the bunks. So, you know, it's a kind of a rough go. But, of course, it was all for a purpose. And the purpose was to have us leave behind all this individual baggage and get used to the idea that, you know, we're going to be in an organization where you're required to function as a team and where you're required to put the interests of the group ahead of what your particular interests might be. And it's a little harsh, but when you consider that people were coming from all over the country and had never met one another and were at varying levels of maturity, it was something that they needed to do.
So what was training like at Lackland? What kind of things did they have you do?
Well, a good measure of it was physical. Certainly the Air Force wasn't demanding physically compared to what you may have been hearing from people who are in other branches of the military, but it was a lot of marching. And they had, we had to do some running, we had to do calisthenics and this kind of stuff, all in a really tightly organized kind of situation. And then he also had what they called a confidence course, which in plain English would be an obstacle course. I guess if you finish successfully, it boosted your confidence, which is the Air Force is, relative to the other services, again, the Air Force likes, always has like to do things a little delicately. So there's a lot of that. And there's a lot of, you know, there were tasks which otherwise you'd regard as menial. I mean, by golly, the floor in the barracks had to be perfectly polished. And there were newer barracks, but we were in old wood frame barracks that had a basically World War II vintage. Okay. And there were two levels, and you had an aisle down the middle, and you had two rows of bunk beds down each side. But it was the old tile that you had to wax polish and that sort of stuff. And so, you know, you had to get that buff to the highest shine, and the smallest little blemish in the shine was cause for great chagrin. First on the part of the training instructor, and then secondly, of course, on our part. So there were a lot of things, the tasks in many cases were what you would call menial that we had to do. So we were going through that. But then, of course, at the same time, you're getting administratively processed in to the Air Force. So we had dental exams, I remember. We had any number of other things, issuance of uniforms and various other things that were administrative. And then, of course, there was the initial screening to figure out who would be going to what sort of career fields, and in turn, where they would be going when they finished with the boot camp. And as far as I know, obviously I didn't have a bird's eye view at that time, but as far as I know, there may have been sort of tentative, sketchy plans for people, but I don't believe that it was, everything was really ironed out, because I took a language aptitude test and some other things, and no final decisions, I believe, were made until people had, if they were going to have those, until they had taken all those sorts of tests and so forth. So. Okay.
So how long were you at Lackland?
Boot camp was 6 weeks at that time.
Okay.
And as probably anybody else would tell you who's been through it, every day seemed like a century, but the whole thing seemed like about 10 minutes when you look back. Time perspective, your world is controlled, and so your time perspective becomes sort of warped.
Okay.
You're up at 5, and the lights out, it seems to me, was 9 or something like that. So officially, anyway, 8 hours of sleep were permitted, and you, like it or not, ate 3 meals, by golly. and so your whole environment was controlled. But it was six. In fact, it was 6 weeks.
Okay. So at the end of the 6 weeks, did you have a specialization yet, or no?
I was assigned one. I was assigned to work in command post. And I'm not sure if I'm jumping ahead, so please redirect me if you need to. But the next stop was actually very close. I had the opportunity to take vacation, or leave, as it's known in the military, for 10 days, I think it was. So I went back to the East Coast and did that. But actually, I was, as far as travel from boot camp to the first place of permanent assignment, it was almost literally across the street, because it was at Kelly Air Force Base, also on the southwest side of San Antonio, really only separated from Lackland Air Force Base by a short highway.
Okay.
So I was scheduled to do that, but for reasons that I never fully understood, apparently the commander of the unit there, the colonel or general, whichever he was at the time, didn't want any newbies like me. He didn't know me.
Okay.
It wasn't like, I know that Braden guy and I don't want him around. He just didn't want any freshly minted recruits.
Right. This is the idea in general of newbies.
Right, exactly. He was insisting on a higher level of experience.
Okay.
And so then they had to decide what to do. And it was really kind of pointless to fund another move. Not that mine was pretty small. It was basically a duffel bag and me in an airplane ticket at that time. But they didn't want to do that. And so I eventually wound up working in the personnel field. And that's where I started.
Okay.
And did a good bit, actually, totally, of my military career was in personnel-related work. But that's where it started there at Kelly Air Force Base.
Okay. How long were you at Kelly?
I was at Kelly until June of 1973, so it was a little more than a year and a half.
Okay.
I had actually arrived in November of 71,
okay.
So I was there a little more than a year and a half. I had met and worked with other guys in the personnel office who were a couple of years older than me and a couple of years ahead of me in the Air Force, who basically encouraged me to fill out what was called a dream sheet, to list places I would like to go, because basically they said, they're going to send you somewhere before too long, you just can sort of count on it, so you have a chance if you list your preferences and give them something that they might like, you know, a place to send you. So I did that, and some guys actually encouraged me to volunteer to go to Taiwan.
Okay.
I seem to remember somebody calling it the best kept secret in the Air Force or something. It wasn't Vietnam itself, but in actuality, the base that I wound up going to in Taiwan, where the American presence actually was, it was a Chinese base. The American presence was there basically for the purpose of flying supply support into Vietnam, and so it was an airlift unit. They had cargo airplanes.
Okay.
So I went over there in July of 1973.
Okay. Was that the first time you'd ever been overseas in your life?
I'd been to Canada, but I'd never been over the ocean before.
Okay. Now, what was the flight like over there for you?
It was real long. it was an airplane that the military had chartered with what was then known as Northwest Orient. Seemed to be what part of Delta, I think, or something like that, out of Seattle. So, again, after the time in Texas, I was given the chance to take some vacation, so I went back to the East Coast, and then flew out to Seattle, and from Seattle, we flew to Taiwan. I was just trying to remember whether we stopped in Alaska or not, and I'm having a little trouble bringing that back. We stopped in Japan. You know, we took, what's the expression, the Great Circle Route?
Okay.
Which curvature of the earth has always befuddled me, but it's shorter to go up to Alaska from there and across and then down than it is to go what seems like directly because of the curvature of the earth. I believe we may have stopped in Alaska.
Okay.
But we definitely stopped at Yokosuka Air Base in Japan outside of Tokyo.
Okay.
And then finally on to Taiwan. And now this was not calculated the same way the boot camp thing was, but I remember landing in the dead of the night in Taipei. but there weren't screaming senior NCOs waiting to make my life miserable when I got off that airplane. That was very different from that point of view.
So what was Taiwan like?
In what sense?
You landed at night, but then when you first saw during in daylight, what were your impressions?
Well, we were in Taipei, which is the capital and the largest city. Yeah. So it was very busy, and for the first few days, everything seemed to be going like on fast forward. You know, there was a lot of traffic, though in those days, not so many people had cars in those days there, but a lot of people had motorcycles. So it just, you felt, not huge ones, but you just felt like there were motorcycles and motor scooters like buzzing around like mosquitoes almost. It was a little hard to adjust to at first. And I arrived in July, so Taiwan is semi-tropical, so it was real warm and real humid. You know, probably, I couldn't tell you the exact temperature, but a reasonable guess would be that it was 90 degrees and the humidity was 90%. You know, so you just felt hot and clammy all the time, and that was even after San Antonio, which is plenty hot in the summer, but not quite as humid. But my actual destination was not, final destination was not Taipei. My final destination was a place called Qingzhuangdang Air Base, which is about two and a half hours down the western coast of the island from Taipei, outside a city called Taichung, which is a good-sized city, but not as large as Taipei.
Okay, so how long were you assigned to that airbase in Taiwan?
I was there from July of 73 until November of 1974, so about a year and a half.
And were you also in personnel there?
Or? I was in personnel.
Okay.
Another thing that happened, of course, was, if you can bear a timeline in mind, shortly before I had gotten there, the peace treaty had been negotiated between the United States and the North Vietnamese. And so by the time I arrived, the reason for the presence there of American Air Force really was sort of dwindling away. And there was a whole exercise. The unit was, for the most part, sort of not disbanded, but it was... its subcomponents, most of them were sent to other places, some to Clark Air Base in the Philippines and some to Perdita Air Base in Okinawa. But I wound up staying and spent a little bit more than a year as a consequence. I also got married there.
Okay. Did you have much chance for taking leave when you were in Taiwan? Or?
Yes. We got to try... You know, when you marry someone who lives there, of course you have a perfect tour guide, right? But I got to travel fairly extensively around the island, which is not very large, but I've heard the dimensions and the square mileage compared roughly to about the state of New Jersey. But New Jersey's flat, and Taiwan is not. Taiwan's real mountainous. And in those days, the highway network wasn't primitive, but it wasn't nearly as well developed as it is today, so travel was slower.
What were some of your responsibilities then in personnel?
I did a number of different things, but as much as anything else, as frequently, I worked with processing people who were leaving there to go somewhere else. We got the assignment instructions for people, and it was pretty comprehensive. It said where they were supposed to go, when they needed a report. And also, there would sometimes be special added instructions about they might need to take some kind of training on the way, en route someplace else, different things about special equipment they might be required to take with them, or whatever it might be. And we were also involved with arranging people's flights for them to leave the island and go wherever it was they were going.
Okay. Was that for both like military and like the charter flights for civilians?
Right. Right now I can't remember whether there were more charter flights or more. I think it was mostly still charter flights that were going at the time. Sometimes people got booked individually on commercial flights, but Most often it was charter flights.
Would people generally prefer the civilian charter flights over the military ones?
People would angle very hard for them if they could get them. The best way I could describe the military charters would be, the way it worked was kind of like Southwest Airlines does. I mean, everything was general admission. So you go barreling onto the airplane looking for the best seat. I mean, they were perfectly good airplanes. They weren't, primitive turboprop, sitting in the back with the baggage or anything. The planes were fine, but they were configured and they were set up to move a large number of people as quickly as they could. And so you got meal and that kind of stuff. But it wasn't big on amenities. So if people could find a way to get on a commercial flight, oh yes, they were very happy to do that.
Okay, so after you wrapped up your time in Taiwan, where were you next assigned?
The next stop was MacDill Air Force Base, right outside of Tampa, Florida.
Okay. Now, by this time you had a wife to bring with you.
This time I had a wife. Okay. Mm-hmm. And she had never been to the United States, before that. Her English was excellent, though, and was really excellent when I met her. I'd like, at this point in life, actually, to have a recording of how she spoke then compared to how she speaks now. But actually, there'd be some differences, I'm sure. But actually, her English was very good because she had been educated at a college in Taiwan that was run by American and Canadian missionaries. Okay. And they did everything in English. But that's not the same as saying you know exactly what to expect, obviously. I had a wife in tow, exactly. We didn't have a whole lot of belongings, but we had some. And, we got a small apartment not too far from the base there. The best news for her was she got a job relatively soon. And so she wasn't staring at four walls and, in a one-bedroom apartment all day, every day. And I suppose climatically, maybe it wasn't all that bad either because the climate around Tampa is not the same, but similar.
Warm and humid.
To what it's like in most of Taiwan. So.
Okay. Now, what were your responsibilities at MacDill?
A couple of different things. It was still personnel. Until I say otherwise, I was doing personnel work because that's also what I did. But I worked in the records department for a time, and we did reviews. There were scheduled reviews that people had to have of their personnel records, where they would come in and everything was rechecked, and if they needed to provide you some kind of a paper document to support whatever it was, they did that. And it was everything from basic identification information to the history of assignments to training that they'd received, that, people got certificates, and it could be an important qualification and so forth. So I did that for a period of time, and then later I was put on processing the officers for their assignments out. And there was a flying training room mostly. So there was a lot of younger officers learning how to fly the specific airplane, the fighter plane that they had there. So there was a cycle. The classes would come and go, and there was to be peaks of activity because a class would be graduating and they had to be, they got their assignments to go elsewhere, and they had to be processed, and then be sort of allies.
What were these pilots like? Did you have much contact with them?
I had some. Okay. LC, I hope you're listening. There's a sort of a scale of insufferability. This is coming from someone who was never a flyer. I think it's still true, and there's really some good reason for it, actually, when you consider this. But it's kind of like a caste system. There's the pilots, and then there's all the rest of us. It's not completely unfair, because after all, they're the guys who put their tails on the line of combat. I mean, they are the combat part of the Air Force. Not like in some other lines of work, there's a disposition that's sort of conducive to it. There's a sort of way of looking at the world that gets developed in the process of this training. You hear people talk about, a gunslinging quarterback in the NFL. The same kind of swagger. Some of them are just great, And no, they need to have it because they need to be self-confident. They can't be shrinking violets doing what they do. Some guys handled it well and could compartmentalize it and put it to work for them when it was really appropriate, and other guys just didn't seem to manage.
So they were like that all the time.
Some of them were. And there's actually within the world of flyers too, this is informal of course, but there was always a pecking order too. Fighter pilots were at the top of the heap, and they'd speak with the greatest of disdain about people who flew what they called trash haulers, in other words, cargo airplanes.
Okay.
They're not high performance, you know, not hotshot stuff. So some were fine, some were not so fine. But you know, the training produces what it produces.
Right. Okay, so how long were you assigned to MacDill?
I was there from the end of November until the summer of 1977.
Okay.
And I got chosen to go to work at again doing personnel work, although not the same exactly, because this was at Headquarters Tactical Air Command at Lang Air Force Base in Virginia, outside of Hampton, Virginia.
Okay.
There, things were a little different. I was paired up with one officer who was one of the good guy flyers. And he was doing different kinds of studies. So I was, in essence, sort of like this gopher and this administrative guy. But it wasn't just pre-programmed, send someone here, send someone there. He was doing studies about the impact of experience and training on the readiness of fighter units and so forth. And he was a guy doing the brain work. There's no way around that. But, you know, I assisted him. And it was an interesting different look for me at the way the Air Force operated, because I'd always, before that, been really kind of right down at ground level doing nuts and bolts kinds of things. But I was only there a year because I had been applying. The transition I forgot to tell you. I joined originally because it was a draft and I was afraid of getting drafted. Well, eventually I changed my mind and decided it might be worth staying around. You know, not to be funny, but I did. And so I started applying to go to officer training. And really in a little less than a year that I had been there at Langley Air Force Base, I got notified that I was selected to go to officer training. So it shortened the time that I spent there.
At Langley.
Yeah, Langley was very nice, a nice area. My only regret was that I really liked the area and would like to have spent a longer time seeing more of the area, because it's just delightful. There's a ton of history in it, I kind of like history, and there's a bunch of good stuff there. But so, in essence, then I went back to Lackland Air Force Base for officer training, which was conducted on another part of the same base.
Yes.
Now, that was 3 months' worth. That was a little longer.
Now, how do they make you into an officer?
I was talking with somebody about this. You can really see the difference if you went through both boot camp type experiences. At officer training, nobody yelled at us. But what they did was, the really critical differences were, in enlisted boot camp, if you didn't really screw up very badly, if you basically kept your head down and your mouth shut and did what they told you to do, you'll go through. In officer training, you were required to get out front and lead. You weren't required to grab, you know, stage a coup d'etat and take over your little unit from everybody else, but on a rotational basis, everybody had to do leadership functions. They put you out front and they wanted to see how you would do in that situation. That was part of the evaluation. How would you do? The other thing, again, there was no yelling. But everybody got, and you're individually, and then your units, we still call them flights, got a bunch of deadlines for things that you were supposed to do. It might be a presentation you had to make. It might be you had to drill your group in marching, and everybody had to do it. You didn't get to choose whether you had to do it. Everybody had to do it. But there were deadlines, one after another, after another, after another, and the pressure was from the deadlines. The pressure wasn't from people yelling at you. And if you were unsuccessful at meeting the deadlines and performing the tasks, eventually you'd just be told relatively quietly, "We're real sorry, we can't have you doing this because you can't do it." And you were It's unpacking. But no one yelled at you. A totally different, a lot of pressure, just a totally different type.
So the pressure was just a lot more subtle that they put on you.
Right.
Was there a lot more peer pressure too?
There's peer pressure at the enlisted boot camp too. Mm-hmm. But yeah, sure there was. Because there was there's always a sorting out in any group of people. And then that is a high pressure environment. And so in 3 months, you had to get yourself molded in a cohesive unit. Everybody had to work as a team, not just to do the chores, but also to, if you could, to help someone in your midst who might be having trouble with part of this to do it. And you're expected to do that, too. You could not be a free agent.
Okay.
Free agents got identified and weeded out quickly.
Okay.
So there was a lot of pressure, but it was a different type, and what you were being expected to do and what they were looking for as their final product was different.
Okay. So after 90 days, you were an officer.
90 days. I think my hat's still up there somewhere. I threw it so high.
So they had an actual graduation ceremony
for
you? Mm-hmm. What was that like?
Really, basically, it was like a formal military parade situation. It's a little hard to describe, but it's very, very formatted. The units are of a really specific size. There's a whole sequence to what happens, presentation of the officers of the different groups, which is all, it's a drill thing. It's not like, well, Johnny, please come up and be acknowledged. It's like all the Johnnies have to march in a very coordinated way, and there's all that kind of stuff. I don't remember if anybody got, there was some kind of awards presented on the reviewing stand. I don't remember exactly what those were. But then all the units passed in review, before the reviewing stand. So the context for it was a formal military parade, but, your graduation was announced at the end.
Okay.
And then you could kind of bust loose a little bit.
Were your families there?
Families were allowed to be there for that. My wife wasn't able to be, but families were allowed to be.
Okay. So now that you're an officer, where did they send you?
They sent me to Omaha, Nebraska. Offutt Air Force Base, which turned out to be actually a good experience. I couldn't have anticipated it, and I'd never been there. It was, in those days, it was sort of legendary in the Air Force, and every place in any branch of the military, I'm sure, has a nickname of some kind, but Offutt Air Force Base was referred to as Awful Offutt, and its location was referred to as Oh My God, Nebraska. But Offutt wasn't awful, and Omaha was a nice town. I'm sure it still is a nice town, actually. Now, the duties there were, I actually recycled back into the personnel business, and the organization that I was in was like the personnel support for all the Air Force people who were assigned there. But there were a number of different organizations there, notably headquarters for Strategic Air Command, which no longer exists. I still want to wear a black armband for that. But so it was large. There was flying that went on there. The headquarters was there. Everybody's at some time heard of or seen a movie about the big underground command post and so forth. That was there. And there were probably, it seems to me there were 12 or 13,000 or more Air Force people who were stationed there totally. So it was a big, big operation, and we were supporting that, again, with all what were the normal personnel functions for the Air Force, overseeing training, people's assignments in and out, management of their records, and also what was known as the Personnel Reliability Program, which was a special set of standards and security clearances, a whole sort of package for people whose duties were defined in any way as having anything to do with nuclear weapons. Everything right down to the police who marched around the missiles out in the absolute middle of nowhere in Montana. So there was a program. It was a very serious set of standards as far as high-level security clearance. And then people who were on it were monitored because you couldn't perform the duties that were defined, if, for example, even if you were on a medication of some kind that could cause your problems with your consciousness or your alertness or your mental processes, people who had, if someone came up with a DUI, that was practically the end of the world. So that part was pretty meticulous and could be pretty challenging and pretty pretty stressful. I didn't have personal exposure to the nuclear weapons, but the personnel function had responsibility for a part of the total program. And that was my first exposure, to that. That was interesting.
Now that's got to be pretty pressurized there.
It was at times, because you had to watch things. I wasn't out there, with the weapons or control of the weapons, but you were expected to real carefully monitor anything that happened that could affect the ability of someone who was. And, if a unit had short staffing, they might try to sort of slip something by because, Johnny just had one extra beer last night, don't worry about him. But that wasn't the way it was supposed to be played, and you had to watch that. It twisted your outlook a little bit, actually. I can remember seeing on TV a news story about an accident or something, and it was mentioned as part of the story that one of the involved parties was in the Air Force and was assigned there. My antenna went up immediately that I had to know who it was to see if this had implications on it. And I was sitting home watching television, for heaven's sake. And again, I didn't even have access to the weapons or the codes or any of that stuff myself.
No,
but you had to be very aware of it.
Yes. If there were problems, it would come back to you. Why was this person assigned there?
Right, exactly. I was the guy who had to point the stuff out and say, hey, such and such a unit, they had what they call suspension. Mm-hmm. Did you suspend Johnny, for personal reliability because of this thing that happened? And they were supposed to answer up to you. So.
So how long were you at Offutt?
Just about 3 years, from November of 1978 until October of 81.
Okay.
So pretty close to 3 years.
So still right in the middle of the Cold War.
So. Yes, oh, absolutely. Yeah, sure was.
Okay, so after your time in Omaha, Nebraska, where did they send you?
They sent me to Germany. They sent me to a place called Spangdahlem Air Base, which is, how can I describe it? The map of Germany is always divided in my mind, east and west. I know it's not, but the old West Germany was sort of almost like a dogleg in a letter L shape.
Okay.
And we were sort of almost to the joint. In the letter L. It was very close to the border of Luxembourg. I could get into Luxembourg by car in 20 minutes or so. France, the closest border in France was not more than an hour and a half away. Belgium was an hour or so. So it was sort of at a crossroads location almost. It was in the country. It's not in the city. As such, it was about enough, 30 or 40 minutes away from the nearest city, which was 100, maybe 100 or 200,000 people, but it was a country sort of a location. And they flew fighters there, and though the military always says that it won't confirm or deny the presence of nuclear weapons, they had them there.
So those would be like the tactical nuclear weapons?
Right.
Okay.
Exactly.
Okay.
They flew, at the time I was there, they flew the F-4. Okay. Which is well retired now, from the inventory. But they flew the F-4, and there were two squadrons that had the nukes, and there was one that was basically to do jamming. They had a name for it. They called it Wild Weasel. Yeah, it was. They had a Wild Weasel squadron and two squadrons that actually carried the nukes.
So these Wild Weasels would jam the radars.
Right. They were the ones who were supposed to electronically clear the path. For the other guys.
Okay.
I don't think I would want to have done it, even if I was a flyer.
That's pretty dangerous.
Pretty dangerous stuff. So maybe you do have to have a little swagger if you're going to do that.
So what was it like living in Germany?
It was great. I enjoyed it immensely. I don't remember if living on the base was available to us or not. I don't think it was, but we didn't, and I've never been sorry. I was delighted that we lived in a German village. I mean, I didn't learn tons of German, but I learned enough to struggle along. It was a really pleasant place. The people were wonderful, and we made some friends that we still correspond with while we were there. It was a great experience. I loved it. My kids went to the German kindergarten in the village, which was actually sort of combines what we would call kindergarten and preschool here, because it was for 3, 4, or 5 year olds. Okay. And though one of the teachers there at least was bilingual, there was no commitment. Kids were going to get English, which was fine with me, because what was the point? You know, I mean, the really great side benefit was that, especially my daughter, who's older, really became pretty fluent in German. She'd have to go back and add water, so to speak, I think, now, you know, to bring it back. And my son understood everything, too. He didn't speak much, but he understood everything, too. And they did their business in German. You know, and it was a really great experience. A really great experience. Then. So the whole business of living out in the German community was a really great experience for all of us.
What were some of the things you did for fun over there?
In Germany?
Yes.
Well, we traveled as much as we could. And if you've talked to other people who've been to Europe, they probably all tell you the same thing, and it's in a different way. It's true for everybody. Everything was close. Europe is so geographically compact compared to this country that in short periods of time compared to what you take out here, you know, you could get to a lot of places. As I mentioned before, Luxembourg was only 20 minutes away, and if you go out the other side in another 30 minutes, you know, it's so small. But it was interesting and unique. And, you know, Belgium was close by. And we had the chance. The Battle of the Bulge, actually, from the Second World War, had passed very close to where we lived and had passed through Luxembourg. Luxembourg was liberated as a consequence of the Battle of the Bulge. So there were a lot of historical things like that to see, and people were very receptive, very friendly for the most part. We've got France, we've got Switzerland, oh Lord, the Netherlands, the UK. I didn't get to spend a long time in any one of those spots because duty was hectic and kind of stressful because it was the Cold War, and you know, you had to at least joke about playing war about once every 2 months minimum, and you know everything changed, and you had different duties for that period of time, and then you had to come back to your regular job and try to catch up when it was over. But when you could get to travel, it was great, and you know we enjoyed it very, very much. And let me mention one other thing too. If this gets edited eventually, I hope, because I know I'm blathering on. But
no,
great. We went to Luxembourg. In Luxembourg, I forget the name of the town, but they had a Patton Day parade every year because it was General Patton's Third Army specifically that had liberated Luxembourg during the Battle of the Bulge. And so he was iconic in Luxembourg. And they asked for Americans to come over and bring a unit and so forth, a marching unit to be in their parade, which they did. And I wasn't part of that, but they also, excuse me, the authorities on the base said, you know, go over, wear your uniform. You know, the reception will be warm. And so I went over. I remember going one time with my son. He was probably 4, maybe, at the time. We went over for the parade. And it was really a very moving experience because 2 or 3 kids who could not possibly have been alive in 1944 and 1945, because they were about 10 maybe, and this was 1983, wanted my autograph only because I was an American in a military uniform. You know, I wanted to say, I didn't do anything for you, but the point was, you know, their parents had told them.
Yes.
And they knew. So that was that was pretty touching.
I wonder if we'd still get that kind of reception today.
Things change, and I'm not so sure. But I do find, with the rarest of exceptions, I found that among Europeans anyway, even when there'd be serious political disagreement, you know, your government's doing goofy things that we don't like or whatever, people were never, it never carried over to person-to-person relationships.
Okay.
So maybe I wouldn't be asked for my autograph today. I don't know about that. But I don't expect that I'd be treated badly on a one-to-one basis. Even with the French, you can be pretty prickly. it's the same. You know, people are nice to you.
Yeah.
As long as you're decent to them, people are very nice, despite whatever political disagreements there might be. Right.
So they differentiate between the government and the American people.
Very easily. Although in the case I just cited there, they didn't want to, and they were very happy about what other representatives of my government had done, you know, at a previous time. So.
Okay. What was your rank by this time?
I was a captain.
Captain.
By that time. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so then after you were done with Germany, where did you head off to next?
Next, I went to Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York, to teach ROTC.
Okay.
And I did 3 years there, three, 4 years.
Yeah. Yeah. How did you enjoy teaching ROTC?
I enjoyed it immensely. The first comment I really need to clarify carefully is I could never have been on the faculty at that school otherwise. They do things I don't understand there. But you actually were acknowledged if you were an instructor in one of the ROTC units, and the Army and the Air Force and the Navy and Marines as a subdivision, so to speak, all had ROTC, and so you were acknowledged as a junior faculty member, and so you got privileges on campus and that kind of stuff. I was really impressed with the young people that we worked with. Rensselaer is it's an engineering and science school, which I think I'm still right to say is roughly in the second rank, just below the MITs and the Cal Polys and those kind of places. So they were highly intelligent. For the most part, they were highly motivated about the military. Though, to be candid, it was expensive, and the scholarship counted for a lot, and if you could get a scholarship, it gave you a way to go to a school that you couldn't remotely afford otherwise. But they were real intelligent, they were real motivated. They didn't necessarily know a lot about the military, which is really where we came in, with a few exceptions. Some were the children of military people, and they knew something at least about the military, but many, many were not. They were fresh out of high school. Learned in this place. So it was really, they were eager, they were motivated, they looked up to us, which, if you're not careful, will inflate your ego, but it also gives you obligations to make sure you're the sort of example you would like someone else to look up to. But that's okay. It was something I was willing to try to do. And it was a very good experience. They also sent all of us, the two summers, the summers after our first and after our second years as instructors, we went to what for the ROTC cadets was their boot camp. They did 2 years, and after their sophomore year, they had to go through, it's a rite of passage, doesn't matter. That was not the way I got my commission, but when you were going by that method, you had to go to a boot camp-like experience after your sophomore year, sometime in that summer, and it was basically a month long. And so we, all of us, went one place or another to the instructors for that. So I did that between two summers. The first time I went to Eglin Air Force Base in the Panhandle, Florida, and then the second time I actually just went up the road about 3 hours to Plattsburgh Air Force Base in way in upstate New York. It's closed down now, I'm almost certain. But they had a section where they were able to do the summer encampment for the cadets, and I did it up there, which was another really sort of a subset, really great experience. The first year I was a little concerned about making sure that I succeeded now being